Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
On our way to our conversation here.
So much happening, folks.
About last night's debate, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end to you. www.mecu.com is their online way to get to them. So I'm trying to say to do that. So we can talk about last night's debate. We have with us Dr. Max Hilaire, chair of the Department of Political Science here at Morgan State University. It's been a while since he's been
a busy man.
Pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you very much. Always I'm glad to be back, Ray.
Dr. Adil Shamu, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Adil, always a pleasure to have you in the studio. Welcome.
My pleasure.
And here we go.
Here we go.
So, and you can join us. What, can people join us?
I don't think so.
I don't know how this is working today.
I don't think there's a way, but it gets confusing. When folks are calling in and they're taking pledge calls, it gets kind of
make a pledge.
So make a pledge. Make a pledge and we'll let you make a comment.
Ooh.
No, that's terrible. Let me take that back.
Like
I'm going to get in trouble.
So let's talk about your general impressions, first of all, last night before we get into specifics. About how both of you would analyze the responses of the president and the governor overall, and what you thought their hold on our foreign policy and foreign policy issues were or were not. Max?
Thank you again for inviting me.
Always a pleasure.
I'm so close, but yet so far from you guys. But I'm delighted to be here and on a very topical issue. My impression, frankly, Mac, to tell the truth, I didn't think the substantive issues were addressed. This is a critical time for the United States, an opportunity for the United States to redefine its role in the world and what it stands for. And I think we missed the opportunity to do so. We've not done it since the end of the Cold War. And I don't think people left the debate with the impression that we know what exactly our role is in the world.
Adil Shamu.
Well, I want to preface by the fact that I want Obama to win. So I'm in a conundrum, basically. I criticize him, as you know, a lot in my writings and on your show and others. And he was way better. However, both of them are really trying to have a scary policies. They don't look at the realities of Middle East and it may go into conflagration, basically, a war in the whole area. They talk about red line on Iran, but they don't talk about any red line to Israel, having 200 nuclear bombs, and they don't sign the non-proliferation treaty. They talk about the whole vision, basically, from the right-wing point of view rather than from centrist even. What happened in the debate, as in all the recent debates, is Romney flipped from right-winger, you know, neocon. 17 out of 24 of his advisors are Bush administration appointee, and majority are neocons. And basically, he was almost arguing with Obama from the left. It's shocking. He couldn't fool me, but, you know, he's trying to fool somebody.
Go ahead, Dr.
Well, I'm not sure Romney fooled anyone. Again, it demonstrates Romney's inability to stick to any one issue, and he moves from one issue to the next, depending on where the wind is blowing. So at the first, during the primaries, he was trying to be as right as possible. The first debate, he took this very strong position that, you know, people gave him credit as being the winner of that debate. And last night he was as passive and moderate. And my impression is Romney simply did not have a grasp on the issues and therefore deferred to the president by agreeing on almost everything the president said.
Well, he was working from Cliff Notes, that's why. You know that in college.
Mark, I found it fascinating that he said almost 20 times, I agree with the position of the president. And so much so that newspapers across the country, many of them lit with headlines, Romney endorses Obama, because he really did. Now, I found it fascinating also that on substance, I think we did come up short. I think the audience, the public, watched a debate where the president tried to be tough, Romney tried to be tough, but they both were very, very careful not to go too far in their mind. And so I think they both held back. They didn't want any gaffes. They didn't want any mistakes that would become the headlines the next day. And I think the polling shows most people who observed the debate thought the president had a better grasp of the foreign policy issues. They did not necessarily think that the president won. Well, I think they think the president won the debate clearly. But I think if we were to talk to analysts like these two wonderful guests we have, clearly both gentlemen did not break any new ground last night, especially when it comes to the Middle East, especially when it comes to our relationship with Israel. And as Dr. Hilaire said, there was no clear vision from the president and certainly not from Mr. Romney on where the United States stands, other than some very flowery rhetoric, where we stand in the world and where we're going in the future.
Except in one issue. He made really, to me, big news, and it's a sort of the absence of the news, and that is he threw the neocons under the bus. Now, unless they know something I don't know, which is, yeah, he's going to change his mind once he becomes president, then they are happy. Otherwise, they must be today really gnashing their teeth.
Can I ask both of you something real quick about, are we getting ready for break?
I think
you have this look.
In less than a minute.
Okay. And so what I want to ask you, and we can talk about it when we come back from the break, the timetable for the withdrawal. Romney said last night, by the end of 2014. And a lot of people saying that was news because he had been saying up until that moment, let's not set a timetable. Let's not let our enemies know when exactly we're going to start pulling our troops. The president is saying, no, we have a clear deadline, a clear timetable. How significant is that for the neocons and the conservatives that Romney said, I'm pulling troops by the end of 2014? And so we can talk about that.
That is a very clear question we have to deal with. And I'm going to raise the issue of what are the issues that weren't raised.
That's right.
And that's probably the fault, I think, in many ways, of the people who are moderating and creating these debates. They did not ask the hard questions. And why is that? So we'll come back to all that right now. We'll take a very brief break to talk about your public radio station, WEAA. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we're talking about last night's presidential debate with our two guests. Dr. Adil Shamu is in the studio, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Dr. Max Hilaire, chair of the Department of Political Science here at Morgan State University. So you threw out a question before we left.
I was very curious. There's been a lot of talk about Afghanistan. There's been a lot of talk last night about Pakistan and our relationship in the region, how close we are to Pakistan. But one thing that stuck in my mind was the timetable for withdrawal from Afghanistan. And the president has been very clear. He's been pretty consistent that by 2014, just like he was with Iraq, he wanted to bring the American troops home. Let the Afghanis start policing their own country. Mitt Romney has, I tried to search online last night, has always been very clear that the president was putting us at risk by revealing a timetable, by being so clear about of time. But just really nonchalant and matter of fact last night, Romney announced he was bringing the troops home. Did that strike either one of you as odd or not odd, but inconsistent at least?
Well, I think it's not odd knowing him because he's been really changing his mind depending on what polls, his internal polls are saying. He really made three major flip-flops and a couple minor, Afghanistan, Iran, and Syria. Yeah. Afghanistan, he said, yeah, we will leave in 2014 and the generals are already getting ready for it, whereas before he said the generals sort of will decide.
That's right.
So that's one. The red line for Iran has changed. There is really no red line the way he was talking about it. And no military intervention, no fly zone, nothing in Syria. So these are three major changes. And there was a couple minor one about Iraq. He wanted to have his troops stay there. as a matter of fact.
That's right.
And he changed his mind there. I mean, that's a minor one. Going back troops, he would have not done it because I think there would be so much uproar in the country. So he changed his mind on 4, 5, 6 major issues. This is why I say the neocons really must be very angry at him, at least if they're not showing it internally, because they were talking passionately about we lost Iraq, you know, as if it was theirs to start with, you know, we're going to lose Al-Qaeda, is going to come back to Afghanistan, etc.
Again, Mac, I look at the Afghan situation and, you know, frankly, the American public is really just tired of
exhausted.
War. They're exhausted. They would like troops to come home. We really don't know what is victory in Afghanistan. There is no win. The longer we stay, the more difficult, the more intractable the problem gets. Whether we leave 2014 or leave 2020, the Taliban is destined to retake control of Afghanistan because the presence of international troops in Afghanistan have not created an a political infrastructure that could assume leadership once international forces leave. Romney, reading the polls, seeing what the what public opinion is with regards to Afghanistan, again, drastically changed his initial hardline position of not wanting to set a timetable. But the timetable is set, and I don't think there's going to be any reversal of it, whether Romney wins or President Obama stays in office.
I mean, there seem to be a couple of glaring things here. A lot of things we're missing from last night's debate about foreign policy. And one, and perhaps if there was a larger group of reporters and questioners at last night's debate, it might have come out, maybe not. But let me start this way. No one seemed to wrestle with what this 21st century brings to the globe. As someone said the other day, another program I was listening to, this is we're going to enter a stage, this is not the American century, it's not the British century, it's really no one's century. This is a century where the world is changing rapidly, and we don't have the hegemony we had. And no one's addressing what that could mean, Dr. Leah, for our foreign policy
and
for our place in the
world.
Well,
I think, a situation that goes back even as far as Bush won the end of the Cold War. We had an opportunity to really redefine a post-war international order. President Bush did not do it. President Clinton came in, consumed with domestic politics, did not put very much emphasis on foreign affairs. And when he did, he found himself in some difficulties in Somalia and Bosnia. And that sort of defined what, you know, U.S. foreign policy was under the Clinton administration, sort of nations building that turned out to be a disaster. Bush still came in with absolutely no foreign policy agenda. We had 9/11 that totally redrew what President Bush came into office intended on doing or not doing. And hence, President Obama, who came in, found himself consumed by a very, very difficult economic problem, and hence has not put a lot of emphasis on foreign affairs. I expected the president, after looking at his inaugural address and saying to the nation and the world has changed and we need to change with it. But we certainly have not changed with the world. And in fact, with all due respect to President Obama, who I love very much, the world is basically leaving us behind because we have not been able to provide that leadership because of the quality of leadership we've been able to produce in this country. And second of all, a mindset that is more sort of looking within than to look at the greatness of the United States when we engage other nations. So the solutions of the United States are not in Washington. They're in probably Brazil, in South Korea, India, China, the European Union. But we think, and members of Congress are thinking, that we can solve our problems, which are not domestic. They are global problems, or they are externally driven. But we're still looking for internal solutions to these problems.
Dr. Shmoo.
Well, I want to give a slightly more pass to President Obama on this topic, and that is, he came to office with such a big hole, we were going to fall into it and have really almost another depression. So his whole thinking really was totally occupied, and his whole policy initiative were all occupied to stay alive first, to turn around the economy. And I think he has stabilized it, and things are moving upward now slightly. And that occupied him. He really had no chance in my book. I think he's a better thinker than the first term has allowed him to be. He recognizes that China is going to be another superpower with us in the next decade or two, not even two. One decade is sufficient. And I think India, Brazil, and Russia even, and Europe as a whole, once they get united and solve some of their financial issues, all these going to be other polar superpowers, basically. So there will be no one monopolar like we've enjoyed it for the past 10 years, basically.
So, I mean, go ahead. We're going to take a break about 90 seconds, but take a
well,
second and we'll come back.
Again, I think we have failed to really realize many of our problems are externally driven. The world is a very interdependent place. And I do not think countries really want to replace the United States as their sole hegemon. There are certain values, certain specificities about the United States that people like around the world, people respect. No one is looking at China as an alternative model to the United States. But certainly, I think Congress is part of the foreign policy establishment. The president needs to work with a bipartisan Congress in implementing a foreign policy agenda. And members of Congress have their own agenda. It is to get reelected, is what you could do for my district that matters. And all politics in Washington is local. So the president finds himself with a hostile Congress, very much consumed by domestic politics, and hence unable to implement his foreign policy agenda.
We have to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We're coming back to take talk about WEA, your public radio station. We'll come back to Anthony's questions and more thoughts from our guests. I want to explore what they argued about last night over Pakistan and nuclear power and Pakistan and Afghanistan and how real or unreal it was from both sides. The fact that Africa was not mentioned once, other than Libya, was not mentioned once in this debate. Talk about South America and more. So we'll talk about all those issues when we come back with our two guests. We're just lucky to have both men in our studio, Dr. Max Hilaire, chair of the Department here of Political Science at Oregon State University, and Dr. Dil Shamu, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus. We'll be back in a minute. Right now we're here to talk about WEAA. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are joined by Dr. Max Hilaire, chair of the Department of Political Science here at Morgan State University, an internationally renowned scholar. We're lucky to have you here at Morgan and in our studios.
Most definitely.
Dr. Adil Shamu, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. And what we talked about, as we're going to break, we're going to talk about what both men said last night about Pakistan, Afghanistan, about the nuclear power of Pakistan and the danger therein. I wonder what your take was on both of their comments. Dr. Hilaire, you want to start?
Well, the situation in Pakistan is quite volatile. Pakistan has been a staunch ally of the United States. But at the same time, Pakistan is in a sort of a transition. No one is quite sure who is in charge in Pakistan. There's a civilian government, there's the intelligence services, and there's the military. Our key concern with regards to Pakistan is keeping tab on the nuclear weapons, that they do not fall in the hands of the wrong people in Pakistan. Second of all, Pakistan as a conduit for or a hub for terrorists launching attack into Afghanistan. And third, the whole issue of this proxy war between India and Pakistan that is taking place in Afghanistan, that Pakistan does not want to see India getting a stronghold in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, after U.S. and NATO forces depart. Hence, Pakistan is playing a double game with the United States. On one hand, showing, demonstrating support, but at the, on the other hand, supporting the Haqqani network and then undermining U.S. Presence in Afghanistan. And that is something, whether it's a Romney administration or an Obama second term, has to really address. And I think the president has done well in using drones to launch attacks into Pakistani territories against terrorists who have taken refuge in that area. But it's a very difficult situation for whoever occupies the White House come January 2013, because Pakistan is not a very reliable ally in this war on terror.
Dr. Doshimu, I mean, your take on last night, and I was talking about what Dr. Hilaire talked about in terms of India, the largest democracy on the planet Earth, really, and what our response should be to all this.
Well, I think Dr. Hilaire summarized it well, but I have a different take on drones, for example. I think our interference with Pakistanis' internal politics, it doesn't serve us well. It only fuels the anti-Americanism in Pakistan, especially the drones. You kill one or two, you don't know who they are, I guess. Here we have courts and Supreme Court and appeals court, right, until we get it right, and we still don't get it right. Here from 10,000 feet above, we throw a drone, and that guy is guilty, and we got to kill him. Well, his children, his family, the ratio is, some people say, it's 50-1, at least 10-1, civilian innocent people are getting killed. That is not a good long-range policy for us in fueling the anti-Americanism and hatred to us. And the opposition, these jihadists or other opposition to our presence there, even though they are small, they're around 10 to 20%. That's huge. One reason our founding father said the minority views should have Bill of Rights, because they did not want the tyranny of the majority, but they did not want those small fractions to wreak havoc with the country, because they can. It only takes a few thousand, basically. And now there in Pakistan is about 10 to 20%. And I think some of our policies, incursion in Pakistan, in invading their sovereignty and not respecting them, and killing their civilians in pursuit of one or two or three or 10 or even a dozen terrorists, it is not in the long range serving us well, unfortunately.
Well, I have to say, from an international law perspective, the use of drone is certainly inconsistent with international human rights, humanitarian law standards. However, it's been a very lethal and effective strategy used by the United States to disrupt and to dismantle some of these terrorist organizations, and certainly save the lives of American ground forces who would, again, in exchange, be on the ground fighting these so-called invisible enemies. So I don't think the president is likely to ease up. In fact, the president has used drones in over 300 instances since coming into office. Yes, lots of civilians have been killed. Some suspected terrorists have been killed. And one would argue, killing, whether it's an American suspected terrorist or foreign terrorist, does not allow this person to have due process of law and to be found guilty and, you know, innocent or whatever. But I think it's a popular strategy with any administration that occupies the White House because of the nature of fighting a terrorist campaign. And hence, we are not supposed to see a decline in the use of drones, but in fact, an increase in the use of drones as we move forward and withdraw most of our ground forces from these regions.
The less our policy is based on moral grounds, the less, the more opposition to us and the more anti-Americanism is fueled. And that is really where the use of drone has increased hatred to us rather than diminishes it. If you take the two equations, I think in the long run, that is killing few terrorists versus the number of people, because the statistics works against us. For every one civilian killed, innocent civilian killed there, we probably produced 50 to 100 hating us, and they're willing to become terrorists. That's calculus we cannot survive in the long run.
Did we, gentlemen, miss an opportunity? Mr. Governor Romney was very clear, and he painted a very vivid picture when he was talking about Egypt and the protests and how people do look to the United States to stand, even if it's just to give a moral pledge of support for democracy. But he painted this picture, and he did it three or four times, of young men and young women in the, women in the streets of Egypt holding up signs saying, "America, will you stand with us?" And that this administration was absolutely silent. And our silence has cost us because Egypt continues to be unstable. Did we miss opportunities there during the Arab Spring?
Anthony, I don't think so. Mm. I mean, you had a situation in Egypt that took the world, well, Tunisia first,
right,
then Egypt, mm-hmm, took the world by surprise. No one expected any challenge, a peaceful challenge to these very staunch authoritarian regimes, particularly in Egypt, and a regime that was very well armed. I think the president played a very delicate balance in, one, not wanting to immediately abandon a very strong ally of the United States in the, a very dangerous environment, but at the same time, remember the president went to Egypt, and even before that, Condoleezza Rice, during her time with the Bush administration, and apologized, saying we had taken positions that were inconsistent with our democratic values, and for very simple reasons, for national security considerations. So the president continued that line when he went to Egypt and called for democratic change in that country. When the protest started, if you recall, the president took a very bold move by coming forward, calling on the Egyptian government not to use force against peaceful protesters, that they had a right to demonstrate. And hence, I think that led President Mubarak to exercise restraint. Had the president not made a statement, I think Egypt would have turned out a worse situation than it is today. So kudos to the president. We may not have gone in directly, but I think just making a statement on the respect for human rights, the right for people to protest peacefully, may have changed the outcome of the revolution in Egypt.
We have to take a very brief break and come back. We're going to talk about WEA and let Dr. Dulshimu come back and have his thought on that same subject. Don't go away. Anthony and I will be right back with our two guests this hour, Dr. Dulshimu, and you just heard Dr. Max Hilaire. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are here with Dr. Max Hilaire, internationally renowned political science theorist and analyst, as well as an expert on international law. He's chair of the Department of Political Science here at Morgan State University. Dr. Adil Shamu, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. And Adil, you wanted to make a comment before we went to break.
Well, I think the Arab Spring is a good example of our foreign policy, how it is American-centric. Mm. We think of it, we should manage it, we should know the outcome, we should know all the actors. What is this business of we are supposed to be for freedom and democracy, and you have 300 million Arabs are in revolt against their corrupt dictators who stole the wealth of the country, who were puppets for the West, serving the masters, let's face it, and then we want everything to be managed to serve us. Well, what about the freedom and democracy? We still talk about, I mean, Mubarak. No, we were very late in telling Mubarak to step down, for example. It took us 1 week to tell Libya, to Gaddafi, to leave. Why? There was a lot of oil. When there is no oil, okay, like in Bahrain and other places, we waited a long time. Even in Egypt, we waited about 6 to 8 months until we called for Mubarak to step aside. And then now we complain, Muslim Brotherhood, as if they are some kind of monsters from Mars. They are human beings. There was an free and fair election, and they won. I don't support all their policy, but you have to respect the sovereignty of people. And that is really where we fail by selective support of freedom and democracy, by selective what they can do to serve us, not to serve their own people first. And then we allow those who are with us, like Bahrain, to kill their people, it's okay, to imprison their people, or Saudi Arabia, which supports terrorists. They actually fund terrorists in Iraq and in Syria.
So let me ask this question to the two of you. I'm curious what questions both of you would have asked if you had been on the panel on foreign policy last night. Do you think were not answered or not brought up? Questions we have to face in this 21st century, Dr. Hilaire.
Well, the question I would have asked candidate Romney is, if he loves America so much and so dearly, why would he put his assets in the Cayman Islands and in a Swiss bank? That would be number one. Second is, given all the economic problems and social problems, educational and whatever, infrastructural problems in this country, why would anyone want to spend a huge sum of money in a time when funds are really tight on building the defense industry instead of rebuilding America? And third is really, how is he going to address some of the unknown and unforeseen problems, whether it's in Africa, in Latin America, as you mentioned before? Those two continents were never mentioned in the debate, like the United. Nor did we mention the debt crisis in Greece.
Right.
The problem may very well expand to Spain, to Italy, to Ireland, to Portugal. Europe is our biggest trading partner, and if there's an economic contagion in Europe, it certainly will hurt the recovery in the United States. None of that was articulated. No one said anything about some of these unforeseen problems that are emerging in Africa. And, you know, as during the primaries in 08, when someone mentioned what happens when you get the call at 3 a.m. in the morning, what do you do? I mean, are you prepared to respond to a phone call at 3 in the morning, whether it's a crisis, whether it's in Russia, in China? I mean, there's a strong possibility Japan and China may end up fighting over two uninhabited islands. No one really addressed that issue. You know, we have the drug problem in Latin America. We have a war in Colombia that's been going on for 40, 50 years. There's the problem in northern Mali, where half the country has been taken over by Al-Qaeda in the Arab Maghreb and other groups fleeing Libya and elsewhere. You know, it's like those are forgotten areas. And it's been sort of that way for the last 12 years. So the Bush administration totally ignored Latin America and Africa, and the Obama administration in the 4 years in office has not done very much to really re-engage Africa or Latin America.
To our own peril. Dr. Shamu.
I would really ask them and corner them, do you believe in parity of behavior of nation towards each other and its action? We sort of give ourselves a freedom to do what we want, to invade another country, to interfere, to recruit their people to serve us. Would they mind then if Russia and China do the same thing? For example, come and interfere in our election or in Canadian election? I mean, this is the thing I ask some military men. I happens to once in a while bump into them. And I'll ask them, what would you do if you saw 1 million Russian troops on the ground in the United States? Without any hesitation, I'll carry arms and fight them. I said, why would you expect the other nations not to do? I was talking in reference to Iraq. Why would you expect the Iraqis not to do the same thing? This is the parity. We don't really think other people are of equal importance and worth to us. And therefore, our actions are excused because we are, right, we are the beacon on the top of a hill, which probably we are. But that should not be pushed down the throat of every other people.
One of the things that I read today when you were talking, I was hearing what you were saying, Dr. Hilaire, about nobody mentioned the debt crisis or what's going on with Europe and the world economy, which is huge in terms of international affairs, is that someone posited that the people who actually back the presidential commission are the very same lobbyists who don't want to talk about that stuff in public. That may be a factor, it may not. I would throw that out there. But I think that but for us not to speak about the economic crisis facing the planet, if that's not the biggest single international policy issue we face, maybe along with I think it's the biggest international policy issue we face.
I mean, and frankly, there's some more. I mean, we have a serious pending food crisis in the world. There's right. also the problem of land. You know, there's a land grab going on in the world where countries like China and others are buying up land in Africa, displacing, you know, small farmers. There's the problem of water in the Middle East, which is huge. And certainly we have this global environmental problem that no one seems to want to accept. I mean, you know, the earth is getting hotter. The climate is really, we see drastic changes, whether it's in the United States, in the Caribbean, and in Asia. And no one really wants to address those issues and think, well, maybe it's the human activities on the planet. What happens if a billion Chinese were to own cars tomorrow? I mean, you know, it would have serious implications for our energy policy that we are not even talking about. Where are we going to get this renewable energy from that we think is infinite? And, you know, we cry at the price of $4 a gallon of fuel. In Europe, it's $8 a gallon. And I mean, you know, let's be real. What happens when it gets to $8 a gallon in the U.S.?
So this way, the commitment I want from my guest tonight, Dr. Max Hilaire and Dr. Dil Shamoos, they'll come back for an entire hour and we can pick up where Dr. Hilaire left off. And I think we need to have this discussion. It's been an honor and pleasure to have you both in our studio tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We have to take a very brief break. Anthony and I come back and complete our hour talking about you and your public radio station, WEAA. Don't go away.